one of those admonitions we often heard as children was, don't talk to strangers. Many of us were groomed, in fact, to be wary and distrusting and fearful, and with good reason, I suppose. Still, according to Lord Jonathan Sacks, the former chief rabbi in the UK, the Hebrew Bible commands us only once to love thy neighbor, but commands us 36 times to love the stranger. Kindness to strangers is a core principle in most of the world's great religious traditions, and yet we only have to look as far as our own national conversation about immigration, or closer to home, I'm embarrassed to say it, my own behavior behind the wheel, making my daily crosstown commute, to see that we've largely tossed that one aside. While we're used to hearing the expressions a complete stranger or a total stranger, I'm struck by the equally common expression perfect stranger and by its unintended double meaning. Dozens of times in my life, I've encountered the perfect stranger, just the right person at the right moment who offers the right word, extends the right kindness, or perhaps points me in a direction I never would have considered. To put that last piece in a more personal context, I do need to share that I've judged myself rather harshly throughout my adult life for not having taken a more conventional linear path to professional success. You know what I mean, college, graduate school, good job, better job, make more money and more money, then you retire, then you die. At the same time, I've taken no small satisfaction in having chosen a more circuitous life path. But I can blame a few perfect strangers for that who have stood right in the middle of my path uninvited. One such person is a member of my home congregation in Santa Monica, Cassandra Christensen, who over 25 years ago stood in the middle of my path and held up a sign that pointed toward this career of chaplaincy so many years later. Sometimes if we keep our hearts and eyes open, that stranger can show up and just guide us in that place we never would have considered. Another example came for me in 1973. I was a freshman at UCLA, majoring in design, very focused on my future career and success. I also happened to really love dancing, and I was taking dance classes at the old Roland Dupre studio on La Cienega in Hollywood. I was even on scholarship, which meant I could take as many classes as I wanted for free in exchange for a few chores around the studio. That's because Roland thought he was grooming a future professional. I knew in my bones that that wasn't in the cards for me, but I went along with the program. Hey, I wanted the classes. I was a part of a small company of dancers who gave a one-night concert performance to showcase the choreography of one of the teachers at the studio, Chuck Moore. One of the other teachers at the studio, Joe Bennett, came to see that performance and was apparently impressed enough with my work that he took it upon himself to invite a friend of his, Walter Painter, a well-known choreographer at the time, to come observe me in class because he knew Walter needed another male dancer to round out his chorus for a season of summer stock at the Sacramento Music Circus. Well, apparently the whole class knew who Walter was except me. They were all knocking themselves out and selling it to beat the band, and there I was, clueless. But I was the one who got the note after class. Michael, please call me about work. So I called him, and he offered me the job. And I'm a little embarrassed to say that my initial response was, Sacramento? In the summer? It's kind of hot, isn't it? What was I thinking? I was 18 years old. What better summer job could there be? And it certainly paid a hell of a lot more than selling bell bottoms at the Broadway or the May Company. So I took the job, and I had the time of my life. Worked my tail off, 5 shows in 6 weeks. You rehearse one during the day, perform the other at night, no nights off. I have the fondest memories of that summer. And it actually marked the beginning of a career as a professional dancer that I said I never wanted, which ended up affording me the opportunity to travel internationally. It paid for the rest of my college education. I still take dance class every Saturday from Walter with a bunch of old dancers some 45 years later. It's the highlight of my week. But I need you to hear, I didn't set my sights on any of it. Just like I never set my sights on this career of chaplaincy, I felt kind of led here. So what is it that makes a stranger sometimes more perfect for us than a friend, a loved one, a family member? For one thing, a stranger generally has no agenda for us, no need to fix us or correct us or contextualize our lives for us on our behalf. More often than not, they're completely indifferent to us. Yet in our bumping up against one another, there can sometimes be a gift, maybe a new awakening, maybe a new awareness, maybe a reminder of an old truth. A few years back, I had a breast cancer patient, Dorothy, whom I would visit in the infusion clinic every week while she was getting her chemo. Her husband, Frank, came with her to every appointment. Frank was a bit of a grumpy Gus. He was kind of a curmudgeonly fellow. He was also a passionate restorer and collector of vintage cars. I listened to many stories about their cross-country trips to various car shows. And one week, Frank was telling me about what happened after the previous week's appointment. That week, he had chosen to drive one of his restored beauties to the appointment, and when they went back out to the parking structure after her infusion, he found the side of his car bashed in. Now, if any of you that have ever been in that situation, you know that instant feeling of outrage and disgust and so much anger. And he makes his way closer up to the car, and then he sees the note pinned under the windshield wiper. Name, address, phone number, insurance information, apology. For weeks, I had been listening to Frank tell me how disenchanted he had become with the human race. And here he was given this gift. Michael, I gotta tell you, it was almost worth the hassle of having to get my car fixed just to be reminded there's still good people out there in the world. Now, it was Frank's creative choice to find the meaning in this ordeal, but it was the stranger doing the right thing that provided the catalyst. Sometimes a stranger can be a kind of teacher of sorts. In the late fall of 2009, my husband Scott and I took a trip to Eastern Europe, and we made a stop to Krakow, Poland, in order to visit Auschwitz and Birkenau. For those of you who've not been, as you might imagine, it's an overwhelming, devastating experience. We chose to rent a couple of those acoustic guides to tour the camps at our own pace, rather than join a guided tour group, thinking that might dilute our experience. It was hard to know what to do with the sheer volume and intensity of emotion that would come up with each step, rounding each corner. There were so many times I wanted to say, stop, get me out of here, I can't breathe. But I knew I had to stay put. I somehow had to bear witness to every inch that I possibly could. It would be a sin not to. In the time since we've gone, there have been those who have asked, why would you have ever wanted to go, particularly as a Gentile? I mean, I get it as it's a place of pilgrimage for Jews, but why was it important for you to go? And it always struck me as an odd question. The best answer I have is that it's important to me to try to bear witness to the absolute worst of humanity as much as I want to bear witness to the best of it. Not only to bear witness to it, but to also try to own that those aspects of humanity are alive and well within me too. Cruelty, anger, hatred, indifference. I try to remind myself and live by the creed that nothing human is foreign to me. It always seemed a little glib to write off and dismiss the Holocaust as some kind of aberration committed by subhuman evil monsters. Thank goodness I'm not like that, huh? It was unseasonably cold for late October, bitterly cold, in fact. As I was walking the camps, I found myself wondering about the more peripheral workers at the camps, who most certainly must have witnessed the most horrific scenes, day in and day out, and presumably went home at the end of the day to normal life. Hi, hon, I'm home. How was your day? Is it humanly possible to compartmentalize to that degree? And just then, this sweet little stray cat rubbed up against my ankle. He was weaving his way in and around my feet, purring his head off, and I squatted down to pick him up, wanted to give him some love. Come here, sugar. Desperately wanting a reprieve from all of this horror, trying to squeeze myself into a tiny bubble of sweetness and light amidst all of this horror. And in the same instant, feeling so guilty for wanting that reprieve and for taking it. And in the same instant, realizing I had my answer. That is how it is done. You simply move into a different bubble of reality. That cat was my teacher. That cat was a perfect stranger. Not long ago, a colleague of mine, a social worker, asked me to go see Bruce in the hospital, who was dying of liver cancer. I only met Bruce the one time, and I only saw him through this very narrow window of critical illness at the end of his life. Still, such a narrow opening can offer a surprisingly intimate view, particularly to the stranger. Bruce is one who had lived his life on a very big stage, one of corporate boardrooms and international travel. His world had now shrunk down to the size of this hospital room. Not having many friends or family about locally, his society had been distilled now down to that of the doctors and nurses and the housekeeping staff that came in to clean his room. Bruce seemed to find himself at a kind of spiritual crossroads. He wanted to connect with the Methodist faith he dimly remembered from his youth. He wanted to pray, but he didn't know how or for what. It all seemed so kind of hollow and empty now. So rather than launch into some lofty theological discussion, we started closer in, and I just asked Bruce to reflect on the magic inherent on the smallest gestures of kindness, tender mercies, if you will. Oh, I understand exactly what you mean, Michael. Just last night, I had the most wonderful conversation with the woman who came in to clean my room. Now, if you met Bruce, you would never characterize him as one who was going to have conversations with the housekeeping staff. But life had changed. The world had changed. And she was it in this moment. Michael, she had such a sweet smile and this manner that just made me feel so at ease. She was so calm. It just felt like it was all okay. She even gave me a little gift. And his eyes filled with tears as he pointed to the little plastic angel sitting over there on the shelf. I knew he had experienced the magic of just being seen, of being witnessed, of connecting. I, for one, put my faith in those kinds of connections, in that kind of connectedness, often between strangers. A number of years ago, I was invited to speak at the cancer support community out in the Westlake Thousand Oaks area to an audience of primarily cancer patients. And after my talk, there was a time for Q&A, and a woman asked me, "What do you think is the meaning of life?" Oh, that. Well, I'm trying to concoct some kind of response, which I didn't have. She didn't wait for me. She wanted to tell me hers, which was as it should be. And she said, "Well, Michael, I think the meaning of life is that everyone wants to be known, as in seen and received." I remember at the time my judging mind going into overdrive thinking, "Well, that's way too simplistic, dear, but thank you for sharing. Is there another question out there?" But I'll tell you, I have quoted her countless times in the years since because I think she came close to hitting it right on the mark. Too many times I've experienced in my own life, I've seen it in the countless patients that I've walked beside, the healing power and magic of just being seen, received, respected, accepted in my life as it is right now, as I am in it. It's not a small thing. A year or two ago, I went to fill up my car at the local gas station, the USA station with the lowest prices in the neighborhood. And that afternoon, the place was jumping. There wasn't a pump available. So I waited my turn. A pump opened up. I pulled up, filled up my car. And then it came time to back out of the station. And I'm checking my side view mirrors. I'm checking my rear view mirror. I'm checking my camera. And then I hear crunch. I'd hit one of those 3-foot-tall posts filled with concrete that was there to protect the apparently very fragile concrete curb surrounding the gas station sign. It was the one spot invisible in all my mirrors and camera. And I didn't realize it in that moment, but it was a $1,500 mistake. Now, anybody who knows me knows that such a mistake is proof in my mind that I don't deserve to live. I wish I were kidding. I got out of the car to inspect the damage, and I'd hit it in just the right way that the rear tail, the rear bumper, the quarter panel, the hatch cover, and the taillight were all damaged. The taillight lay there on the concrete like some wounded animal. While I sat there staring in shock, contemplating my own suicide, I was completely unaware of the man who was pumping gas in front of me, who had seen the whole thing. Big strapping fellow whom you would never cast to be the merciful angel in this moment. He walks over to me and just says, "Oh man, that's rough, dude." Said with all the compassion he could muster. Not knowing what else to do, he bends over and he picks up my taillight and he tenderly hands it to me as if it is my wounded dog. Not knowing what else to do, I walk over to the trash can and I throw it away. And there's a part of me observing the whole scene and kind of can see the preposterous humor of it all. But I'm way too caught up in my own self-reproach and grief, but also gratitude for him. I knew he had softened the blow for me in just seeing it and witnessing it and saying so. He knew how much it hurt. I couldn't thank him enough for his kindness. In our 40 years together, Scott and I have always had cats. And in December of 01, our boy Junior died. After 6 years of living with heart disease and kidney failure and my assiduous care, there has never been one before or since quite like Junior Junebug. It was a Friday morning, and I was at home, and Junior died at home. Scott was en route coming home from New York on a business trip. I decided to stay home with Junior's body, thinking Scott might want to see him to say goodbye before we took him to the vet to get him cremated. Scott's plane lands in the early afternoon. He calls me from the cab, and I said that Junior's gone. And I asked him if he wanted to wait, if he wanted me to wait so he could see him to say goodbye. And he said, no, please, I can't see him like that. Will you please take him in? So I wrapped his little body in a towel, and I took him to the vet. And I sure didn't want to bring his stiff little body in where the waiting room where everybody's got their dogs and cats. So I left him in the car, and I went up to the desk, and I choked it out. And my little boy's gone. Will somebody please come out and get him? I go back out to the car, and I'm holding Junior for the last time. And out comes this little Latino vet's assistant, and when he sees me, his shoulders just go like that. He just got it. I kissed Junior for the last time, and I handed him over, and I got back in my car, and I just sobbed. I was completely unaware of the couple that had just picked up their German Shepherd, and they had seen the whole transaction. They walked over to my car window, and they knocked. And I rolled down the window, and they just said, can we drive you home? I didn't accept their offer, but those five words changed my life. They imprinted my heart with an image of what it means to be seen, to be witnessed, to receive that kind of kindness. So what is it that keeps us from being the perfect stranger, from being the one who's willing to say, I see you, I'll be your witness, I will face my powerlessness to do anything at all to make it better just to come near you? I do think that's it right there. It is not an easy thing to come next to another in their suffering, knowing full well there's nothing you can say or do to make it better. Nothing but be there, nothing but be kind. A year or so ago, I was speaking to another congregation, and this man came up to me afterward, and he said, how is it possible for you to create these meaningful relationships with your patients? It must take a lot of time to build that kind of trust, I imagine, huh? I thought for a moment, no, it doesn't. It generally takes no time at all. Hearts are already broken wide open. The stakes are too high. It just doesn't make any sense to stand on ceremony and formalities. Much in the same way, someone might have a very meaningful, even intimate conversation with a total stranger one meets while traveling, particularly to a very far away place. There you both are, out of your element, vulnerable, away from home. Just doesn't make any sense to stand behind the facades that we use at home. A year or so ago, a good friend of mine lost his elderly mother, and I called him the day after she died just to check in and see how he was doing. He said, the crazy thing is, Michael, everybody keeps waiting for me to fall apart. Me too, I guess. And of course I don't. But I'm finding it strangers that get past my defenses in a way that those closest to me just can't. I had so many wonderful conversations with Randy over the last couple years of his life. 53, colon cancer. Not long before he died, I was walking him out of the clinic, and we were still chatting when we got out to the hallway. And while we were chatting, up comes another patient, gingerly making her way to the front door of the clinic. She's on a walker. Randy says, just a minute, Michael. And he goes and he holds the door for her with a big smile on his face. There you go, sweetheart. He came back to me and he said, you see, Michael, the way I see it, that's my job now, to be kind. That's what I do. Randy's professional life was one that had been animated by intense financial pressures, commercial real estate, all of that. It had now been refined and distilled down to that as one who shows kindness. Cancer had robbed him, disempowered him of so much, but it hadn't taken away that career opportunity. It hadn't stolen that place to still find meaning in his life. Many years ago, I saw an interview on TV between Bill Moyers and Pema Chodron, the well-known Buddhist teacher, author. They were talking about New York after 9/11, and Bill was commenting on how so many New Yorkers after 9/11 weren't behaving like New Yorkers at all. They were really watching out for each other, tenderly caring for one another. But as life slowly grew back to normal, they started acting like New Yorkers again. Pema said that's because after 9/11, New Yorkers really understood in a bone-deep way the groundless nature of life, that there is nothing to hold on to. And when we really get it, the groundlessness of life, the only response that makes any sense at all is kindness to each other and to ourselves. It is so deceptively simple. It is such a wildly undervalued virtue, kindness. And yet I believe it offers us the pathway to being that perfect stranger. And in keeping our hearts and eyes open to recognize those little gestures of kindness extended to us, we get to experience the magic of so many perfect strangers in our midst, particularly those who are willing to drive us all the way home. So be it. Thank you.